General Alger, thank you very much for that very, very, very generous introduction. Thank you. I was going to start by saying brothers in the Dharma, but Vimalakirti always starts when he's giving a discourse in the Vimalakirti Nirdesha by saying friends, friends. So you all know, we all know, that this weekend is devoted to the great Mahayana Sutra, the Vimalakirti Nirdesha, the exposition, the teaching of Vimalakirti. And like other great Mahayana sutras, it's known by a number of different names, which just really brings out, just shows how rich the sutra is and how it attempts to address the many different spiritual needs of individuals. And one of the sutra's names is the inconceivable emancipation, the inconceivable liberation, Achintya Vimoksha. And in chapter 6 of the sutra, Vimalakirti evokes the inconceivable liberation of a bodhisattva. Or rather, as he tells Shariputra, he will tell a very small part of what that liberation consists of. So let me just tell you a small part of that small part, just to give you some notion of this inconceivable liberation. Vimalakirti says that the bodhisattva, established in the inconceivable liberation, has the special power to insert a mustard seed, to insert into a mustard seed the king of mountains, Mount Sumeru, as high, as large, and as noble as it is, without the mustard seed increasing and without the king of mountains shrinking. The bodhisattva has the power to pour into a single pore of his skin the waters of the great oceans, as vast as they are, without the fish, the dolphins, the frogs, and other aquatic animals coming to any harm. He can take in his right hand, as if it were a potter's wheel, this triple-fold, thousand-fold world system, and he can throw it across infinite universes. And all the beings know none of this who are being thrown, and then he puts it back in its place. It doesn't say why the bodhisattva in the inconceivable liberation could do this, but he can. He can take into his body the vast blazing fire that burns up the whole cosmos at the end of the eon. He can take it in without suffering in any way. He can turn himself into different kinds of gods and world protectors and different bodhisattvas and Buddhas. He can transform all the cries and noises of all the beings throughout the 10 directions into Buddha voices, Buddha sounds, into the words of the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, so that they pronounce impermanent, unsatisfactory, empty, insubstantial. And from these he extracts all the Dharma teachings of all the Buddhas. There's an extraordinary passage when Vimalakirti describes the powers of the bodhisattva established in the inconceivable liberation. And it would repay, I think, much meditation. I've really not got much of an idea about what it means, about what the significance of it is. But one thing is very, very clear from a passage like this. The bodhisattva, the great compassionate hero of Buddhism, is not simply a good person doing good things. He is an altogether different order of being, of unique insight and activity, who is capable of great transforming power. And it reminds us not to reduce the bodhisattva to the status of a sort of do-gooder. The being of true wisdom and compassion, the ideal of the bodhisattva, is deeply mysterious and worthy of all our reverence. So a being who dwells always in this inconceivable liberation, in which there are no hard, fixed, substantial beings and objects, for a being like this, all things, all beings are sort of indissoluble. They're transparent to each other. And so he can perform the great work, the great play of liberating all beings. So a bodhisattva who dwells in the inconceivable liberation sees everything in an entirely different way. In response to Kashyapa, we heard about Mahakashyapa from Ratnaguna, how he's the sort of hero of the sutra. In response to a question of his, Vimalakirti says that to a bodhisattva who dwells in the inconceivable liberation, all the maras, that is, all the beings and forces that would obstruct the bodhisattva's work, are in fact, to the bodhisattva who dwells in the inconceivable liberation, are in fact bodhisattvas in disguise. They're all helping him in his work so that he can practice the paramitas. And Vimalakirti says this amazing thing: only a bodhisattva can harass, can trouble another bodhisattva. This is fantastic stuff. You know, a bodhisattva has a completely different relationship to what arises, especially to difficulty and obstruction. Sees it in an entirely different kind of way. And there's a great message for us in that teaching. After this truly awe-inspiring chapter, chapter 7, which is called The Goddess, the Devi, seems to kind of calm down in a way. It seems to come down to earth, or at least get to come to practicalities. You'd think after a passage like that that, you know, you just dissolve into silence. Well, let's just stop the sutra there. You know, we've got enough. But no. Manjushri, the great bodhisattva of wisdom, has other ideas. It's as if he wants to draw out from Vimalakirti, well, how can you approach that? How can you start to see in a different way? I mean, you've got all these magical powers for the bodhisattva dwelling in the inconceivable liberation, but you know, how do you get there? So he asks Vimalakirti, good sir, how should a bodhisattva regard living beings? And Vimalakirti replies, Manjushri, I'm just going to give you an extract from this. Manjushri, a bodhisattva should regard all living beings as a wise man regards the reflection of the moon in water, or as magicians regard men created by magic. He should regard them as being like a face in a mirror, like the water of a mirage, like the sound of an echo, like a mass of clouds in the sky, like the previous moment of a ball of foam, like the appearance and disappearance of a bubble of water, like the core of a plantain tree, like a flash of lightning. And he continues in this vein for some time, and then concludes, precisely thus, Manjushri, does a bodhisattva who realizes ultimate selflessness consider all beings. So this is the way a bodhisattva sees all beings. So what are we to make of this? Actually, I think one of the things going on here, Vimalakirti is describing a sort of meditation on living beings. So what are we to make of it? Of course, the way we see others is surely not like this. As we look around this room at one another, do we see one another, in fact, as being like reflections of the moon in water? Or like magical creations, as if conjured up by a magician, and which could so easily vanish when the spell ends? What we're actually struck by, if we look, is the sheer physicality of this scene. You know, the floor is solid, you know, the walls are solid, and you know, when we consider one another, we're definitely made of flesh and bone. We're definitely here, definitely present to one another. And the idea that we're simply reflections or magical creations or dream images, which is another image that Vimalakirti uses, is absurd, surely, and really rather disturbing. You know, perhaps we've had those sort of illusory moments in the midst of a shopping mall or something like that in the middle of the Christmas. You know, those terrible moments where the kind of weirdness of this scene is just weirding you out. And you don't actually, you just want to get out because it seems so illusory and weird. Unreal city, as T.S. Eliot describes, you know, London on a foggy morning, unreal city, and it's not a nice unreality. So if all this is illusion, what's actually the point of anything? What's the point at all? If it's all illusion, there's no meaning, no purpose to life. Loved ones don't mean anything. Family doesn't mean anything. Spiritual friends don't mean anything. Buddhism doesn't mean anything. Surely we would rather not contemplate that. It's too depressing. So no, we're not illusions. We can walk on this earth. We can eat our bread and drink our water. It's there, and other people are there with us, and we can be with them meaningfully. We can love them, and we can be loved by them. We can affect others. They can affect us. But actually, is it so simple? Is our situation dealt with so easily? Is the notion of the illusory nature of things dismissed so easily? Vimalakirti doesn't only use the image of magical illusion and mirage and dream. He uses images that are much more familiar. He says that a bodhisattva regards living beings as being like the massing of clouds in the sky, like the appearance and disappearance of a bubble of water, like a flash of lightning. And I think we can relate to these images much more easily because they evoke vividly, powerfully, the transience of life, the transience and fragility of life. These images evoke the profound impermanence of living beings. And this is something that we really can't argue with. We might be able to dismiss the idea that we're like magical illusions and dreams by stamping our foot on the ground and feeling our sheer physicality and the physicality of one another. But we cannot refute impermanence and transience. We are here now, but we know that one day we will not be here. Our loved ones are with us now, but one day they will not be with us. They will leave us. All of the people and things that we love, that we rely on, that give us meaning, all in the end will pass away. They will vanish. They are indeed like clouds massing in the sky, and we are indeed like clouds massing in the sky. You know, clouds come together, form those wonderful shapes, and then they break up and fade away. We are indeed like water bubbles thrown up by the rushing stream, only to vanish and pass away. Now, we tend to see impermanence like this as something that's happening in the future. But in fact, when you look, when you really pay attention, when you look more closely, more deeply, when you really regard things, the transience of life is happening right now, right at this instant. Experience is sort of instantaneous. It is, in fact, like a lightning flash, completely ungraspable, unholdable, always slipping away, always defying us in a way. Not long from now, this talk will end. Maybe it'll be a good talk. Maybe it'll be rubbish. Maybe you'll enjoy it. Maybe you'll be bored. Maybe you can't wait for the tea break. You'll be having all kinds of experiences and sensations. But this vivid experience, good, bad or different, will end. It will vanish. We'll go to the tea break. We'll go to our groups later on today. We'll go home. We'll sleep in our homes. And if we were to look back on this talk, on this weekend, we'd think, well, what was that? It was sort of happening. I was in it. It was vivid. But it just vanished. Even while it was happening, it was vanishing. Experience is like a lightning flash, vivid but already gone. So when you consider like that, I think you can begin to relate to the idea that living beings are like a magical illusion, like a dream, like a mirage. It's all slipping away. We can't hold on to any of it. This is the way the Bodhisattva regards living beings all the time. Actually, I suspect that all of us deeply know, deeply sense the transitory and illusory nature of life, of one another. We begin to know that as soon as we begin to encounter the world as children. Think back to those times when life disappointed you. There we were, happily playing, and we fell and hurt ourselves, or our best friend let us down, or we lost a favourite toy. And it just goes on throughout life. We lose our loved ones, our business fails, we encounter illness, friends leave us, and so on and so forth. There's bereavement. We know all this. But actually, we find it very, very difficult to really let it in most of the time. It's simply too challenging, too shocking, too real. It would demand too much of us to take this right in. It would actually demand a complete overhauling of ourselves, you know, to live with this knowledge, with this reality, to really live in that presence. You know, and it is interesting that people seriously take up a spiritual life. One of the reasons that can happen, when they start waking up to this truth, when they start letting in this reality. But a bodhisattva is someone who sees thoroughly, deeply into this illusory, transitory, insubstantial nature of all living beings, of all life. In fact, according to Vimalakirti, the Bodhisattva doesn't see living beings at all. In his reply to Manjushri, Vimalakirti says that the Bodhisattva sees living beings as being like space, or like the track of a bird in the sky. So what does this mean? Well, it doesn't mean, just in case you get the wrong idea, that the Bodhisattva walks around in a sort of alienated way, like a sort of space cadet, you know, and kind of not really present, you know, the sort of thing I mean, out of it. It means that the Bodhisattva's sense of transitoriness is so thoroughgoing that he can't really use a word like living being to describe what we call a living being. In fact, Vimalakirti goes completely absurd. I think sometimes these Mahayana boys in the compiling of the sutras, they like a bit of a laugh, you know, it's all quite hefty stuff. So they like a bit of a laugh. So they say, you know, that Vimalakirti says he sees living beings as like a tortoise hair coat, like the erection of a eunuch, the pregnancy of a barren woman, a third rebirth for a once returner or whatever it is, and so on and so forth. You know, we use words like living being, human being, person, man, woman, and we are completely sure of what we mean when we say it. Completely sure. And of course we fix people into categories, and of course we go further. John is like this, Mary is like that. We define them, we fix them, we fix ourselves, and maybe we have all kinds of clever psychological theories. We form pictures, have stories and images of one another, and our world is defined and established and it's fixed. Not so for a bodhisattva. His acceptance of the impermanence and transitoriness of living beings is so deep and so thorough, he will not fix, he will not define other beings. And of course himself. So the idea of living being, human being, vanishes into space. That notion, living being, human being, can't possibly describe what is seen. Instead, wonder arises. Wonder. And this relates back to seeing all beings as magical illusion. The word in Sanskrit for magical illusion is maya, which is actually also a word for art. It's something, it connotes something creative, and it has You know, it has the notion of a sort of creative display. And it has connotations, actually, of beauty and luminosity. So a bodhisattva sees living beings cleansed of limiting and habitual views. He sees them, let's use, you know, rather prosaic language, as dynamic. He sees them as a sort of beautiful mass of potential and possibility. This is the magical realm, the landscape of wonder that the bodhisattva wanders through. This is the world with all its being seen without solidifying concepts and attachments. Perhaps, you know, when we, you know, reflect on this passage from Vimalakirti, we can perhaps sense from this why it is and how it is that a bodhisattva is capable of great transforming power, of great skillful means, how he might build a heaven in hell's despair, how he might build a Buddha field out of this sorrowing world of ours. Certainly, if we're serious about Buddhist practice, serious about following the path, we will need to learn to see the profound impermanence, transitoriness and insubstantiality of all living beings. It's fundamental. Learning to see like that. Obviously, we need quite a bit of support in doing that, particularly with meditations like the mindfulness of breathing, the metta bhavana, practices like puja, spiritual friendship, dharma study. But sooner or later, we need to start really imbibing this truth. Vimalakirti ends his discourse by saying, "Precisely thus, Manjushri, as a bodhisattva who realizes ultimate selflessness, consider all beings." And then Manjushri asks another question, and it's an extraordinarily important question. If a bodhisattva considers all beings in such a way, how does he generate the great love towards them? It's a crucial question. If all beings are illusory and transitory, how do we love them? What's the point of loving them? What's the point of anything? There's a great mistake, a great error made by people with a superficial understanding and practice of the Dharma. It's a sort of false Dharma, a spectre of Buddhism. People read about emptiness. They do a bit of meditation. And they think that Buddhism teaches that nothing matters. And it actually doesn't matter what you do, what your behaviour is like, because it's all empty, it's all illusory. Seems to have been a problem throughout Buddhist tradition. In the 10th century in Tibet, the great Indian master Atisha was asked, or after giving a teaching on emptiness, he was asked by his disciples, and presumably this was their experience in Tibet at that time. "Many say that they have realized emptiness, but their anger and attachment remain." We might add, or not put a question in another way, "Many say that they've realized emptiness, but their indifference and alienation and lack of feeling has become intensified." Atisha replied to his disciples, "They are speaking vain words. When you realize emptiness, your body and mind respond with pleasure, with joy. It's the joy, the pleasure of all attachments, all bonds, dissolving." He says it's like you feel like fresh butter dissolving into barley soup, or like cotton that has been made soft. So when we see impermanence and transitoriness, insubstantiality, maya, illusory nature, we soften. Our sense of separate selfhood softens. There's joy, there's happiness, and there is love flooding out to others. If not, well, the insight is very, very partial, or it's not really insight at all. For a bodhisattva who sees deeply into the Maya-like nature of living beings, the only response is love. The only possible response to the wonder of others is love. Not any kind of love, it's love of an altogether different order. It's the great love, the Mahamaitri. It's not sexual love, it's not attached love, it's not exclusive love, it's not maternal love, it's not paternal love, it's not even ordinary friendliness, although that is a good place to start. It's Mahamaitri. It's great in extent. It's vast. It's for all beings. Whoever a bodhisattva meets, whatever they're like, he will have love. And it's great in the sense that it's profound. It's founded on the depths of reality. It's founded on the truth. In Buddhism, truth, reality, and love are intimately connected. If you see deeply into the truth, you will love deeply and broadly and with great purity. And if you really do love others, you will see the truth. You will need to see the truth. So love must have integrity. Often, perhaps in our experience, what we describe as love and what we describe as truth can feel separate, even in conflict. But perhaps that's because our idea of the truth is flawed and our loving is no more than our hopes and attachments. So Vimalakirti says, by way of reply to Manjushri's question about developing the great love, Manjushri, when a bodhisattva considers all living beings in this way, he thinks, just as I have realized the Dharma, so should I teach it to living beings. And he then tells of the great love, line after line. He just goes through what the great love is, saying that what it is, and it's obvious, clear, it's an active love expressed, making a difference. It just goes through quality after quality, and I've got no time to enumerate all of these qualities. I just want to look at some of these qualities, and I particularly want to draw from looking at these qualities not simply the effect on our personal practice, but how it might affect our building of spiritual community. We are, after all, concerned with one of Vimalakirti's concerns is the purification of the Buddha field or the building of the Buddha land. So we'll look at some of the things Vimalakirti says from that point of view. First of all, Vimalakirti says a bodhisattva develops a love that is truly a refuge for all living beings. So the bodhisattva's love provides refuge and protection for others. This means that the bodhisattva's love is a completely reliable love. The bodhisattva is a completely reliable being. The bodhisattva's love doesn't waver, doesn't let others down. In another place, Vimalakirti says in his exposition on the great love that the bodhisattva's love is a love that is the way things are because it remains the same in the three periods of time. So life changes, people change, people are sometimes pleasant, sometimes unpleasant, sometimes they're with us, sometimes they're far away from us. But the bodhisattva's love is constant and unwavering. It remains the same, whatever's going on around him. It's just this continuous stream of loving kindness, regardless of change. This is, of course, the quality of a true friend. You know, we know who our true friends are because they've always been a friend, regardless of the ups and downs. And this is, of course, what characterises a true sangha, a true spiritual community. A sangha begins to really happen when everyone within it are consistently behaving with loving kindness to one another. And this is when the sangha can become a refuge, when everyone within the sangha are a refuge to everyone else, when all of them are completely spiritually reliable to one another. Sometimes you hear people complain, I feel let down by others. People have done this, they haven't done that, they haven't helped me. I feel disappointed in the Sangha. I feel let down by life. They don't put it in those words, that's what they mean. Well, when you're like that, you've really missed the point of the Sangha, and indeed of the Buddha and the Dharma. Being in the Sangha is not about what others do for you. It is, of course, about what you do for others. In the end, it's about being a source of deep spiritual reliability to others, a refuge for others. In our own order, there are two aspects to our ordination ceremony. There's a private ceremony and a public ceremony. And in the private ceremony, you go alone. And the symbolism of this is that you are committed to following the spiritual path regardless of what others do or don't do. As Sangharakshita, our teacher, used to say when he used to do these ordinations, he used to say, you're prepared to go for refuge and gain enlightenment, even if everybody else in the world isn't prepared to do it. Well, that means you're committed to the development of unconditioned love. You're committed to the great love. Regardless of what other people want to do or how they are, you're committed to loving, because, of course, loving is essential to enlightenment. So the Bodhisattva is concerned with developing a love that is truly a refuge for living beings. And Vimalakirti goes on, he says the Bodhisattva develops a love that has within it no kleshas, no poisons, no afflictions, no negative emotion, no hatred, no craving, no attachment, no jealousy, no conceit, no confusion. Usually our so-called love is bound up with such poisons. But the great love is free of all that. So Vimalakirti says that this great love is a peaceful love. A peaceful love. And he also describes it as a love without any fever. Without any fever and without any obstacle. It just goes on and on. It has no limitations. Could sound that such a love, when it says it's a love without any fever and that it's peaceful, it could sound that it's a rather weak loving kindness, but that might be because we find it hard to imagine strong, powerful, positive emotion without that having self-centeredness. You've got one of these great mysteries. A Bodhisattva's love is very strong, very powerful, very effective, but free of any fever of self-interest. It's a completely pure love. As Vimalakirti says, it's purified in its essential nature. So within the Sangha, we need this kind of love. We have to develop this kind of love, because the thing about the spiritual community, you're thrown together with many, many kinds of people. People you wouldn't normally choose to be with. You actually wouldn't want to be with if you hadn't become a Buddhist. You know, the only thing you've got in common is the Dharma. And they'll seem weird, odd. You don't like them. You think they're complete, you know, idiots, plonkers, whatever language you use. But you've got to get beyond that. You know, you've got to move beyond that. Because as Sangharakshita says, well, you can't. You're not going to leave. And you can hardly say, hey, I don't like you. You've got to leave the Sangha. You know, you can't do that. So that means you've got to overcome all these likes and dislikes, all these attachments and aversions, and purify your loving kindness. You know, we don't actually, you know, we couldn't take somebody as challenging as Vimalakirti as a guru. We wouldn't be Vimalakirti walked in right now. I mean, we'd have real trouble. But we don't need them, because we've got all these weird and wonderful people in the Sangha to go beyond our limitations in loving. So it's a training in loving kindness that we're involved with. So if we want to create Sangha, we need to train ourselves in the practice of continuous, unbroken, unlimited, purifying loving kindness. And this will involve the development of all the qualities that are necessary for the attainment of enlightenment. No less than that. So Vimalakirti says that the love, the great love of the Bodhisattva, he enumerates how it generates the whole of the Bodhisattva's path to enlighten them. Vimalakirti says that the Bodhisattva's love is his high resolve, his powerful motivation, which he says is unshakable, like a vajra, a diamond, a thunderbolt. And this motivation, this powerful motivation to gain enlightenment for all beings, will be expressed in his practice of giving, morality, patience, energy, meditation, wisdom, and skillful means. I'll just read that bit of his teaching. So he says it's the love that is generosity, because it bestows the gift of Dharma free of the tight fist of a bad teacher. It's the love that is morality, because it improves immoral living beings. It's the love that is patience, because it protects both self and others. It is the love that is effort, because it takes responsibility for all living beings. And in the original Sanskrit, or the Sanskrit term for this, it's not just take responsibility, it's much more powerful. It's the love that carries the great yoke of living beings along with it. So this tremendous sense of somebody really responding, you know, to the gravity of living beings and their suffering. It is the love that is meditation, because it refrains from indulgence in tastes, doesn't get caught up in distractions. And it's the love that is wisdom, because at all times it understands the way things are. And it's the love that is skillful means, because everywhere it shows the way. You know, Ratnakuna's description of Vimalakirti going to all places to show the way to the Dharma. But it comes from the great love. So this is incredibly important for us in a Sangha. You know, Sangha isn't just a sort of social group. The Sangha is made up of those who are deeply, powerfully motivated by the urge to gain enlightenment for the benefit of all beings. Sometimes I think lack of motivation is the biggest problem in the spiritual life. People just don't want it enough. They're not motivated enough. When I look at myself, and I look at my, you know, my particular failings, you know, what it comes down to, you don't want it enough, Padmavajra. You're not interested enough, actually. You know, you haven't actually awoken yet sufficiently to the transience of life. You haven't evoked that force of love in your being. You know, Dogen makes this point, you know, that people don't make progress, great Zen master Dogen, because they don't see impermanence. They don't realise that they're born in the morning, they die in the evening, and they don't have desire. He says, you know, if a thief wants to steal a precious jewel, or you want to make the acquaintance of a beautiful woman, you'll do everything to make that happen. You know, you remember when you're in love, you know, and you were going to arrange you to meet somebody. The cunning, the wisdom, the awareness, the imagination, the resourcefulness that you brought to bear to engineer that meeting. Incredible. Well, imagine that going into your spiritual practice. You know, I often say this, you know, how in the community that, you know, somebody says, fancy meditation and puja? They're like, no, I'm a bit tired. I'm watching a video. Oh, yeah. And the energy, you're up. So we need this powerful motivation. We need to really look at motivation. The motivation to generate the great love. Vimalakirti also says, and I love this particular this particular saying, he says, the Bodhisattva generates the Bodhisattva's love that continuously ripens and matures and develops living beings. Robert Thurman consistently translates the term here as develops, but the word in Sanskrit is paripachana, which means, it has lots of meaning, but it can mean ripen, mature, or even cook. Sometimes Surita says, when we're talking about somebody's readiness for ordination, he goes, not quite cooked. Oh, I sort of gave something away there, didn't I? So he developed this great love of the Bodhisattva is the Bodhisattva's love that continuously ripens, matures, and develops living beings in the direction of Buddhahood. This is so beautiful. This is what the great love does. It causes us to ripen and mature and develop as human beings, as spiritual beings. You know, it's like when you experience such love. You know, when you have a good spiritual friend or somebody who really encourages you, maybe not just in Buddhist life, but maybe just, you know, just a human friend. Being with them, you just have that feeling that you're unfolding and changing. That's a wonderful thing to give to people. You want to make spiritual effort. You know, great spiritual friends emanate this kind of love, and just sort of being in their presence makes a difference to us. But remember, this is what we must do for one another. You know, it's not about I've got to find some fantastic wonder-working guru who I can go and stand in their presence and I'll just unfold. We actually have to do this for one another. We all have to be bodhisattvas in this world. We all need to develop this vigorous, maturing, cherishing love for one another. You know, and of course this should affect the atmosphere, the environment that we're in. You know, a Buddhist centre, our home, our workplace, if possible. Everywhere we go, we should be creating an atmosphere where as soon as somebody comes into that environment, they want to. They want to unfold. They want to mature. In traditionally in Buddhism, metta, maitri, is regarded as a sort of magical force that affects the environment directly around us. It's the great magical practice. Vimalakirti also says that the bodhisattvas develops the great love, which is the Buddha's love that wakes people from their sleep. Buddha means one who's woken up from the sleep of ignorance. So the love of a bodhisattva wakes people up. And the bodhisattva might not be gentle about it either, as we've heard about Vimalakirti. They might shout at us and rip off the bedclothes. I remember one day I was spacing out in meditation. I mean, spacing out, not in the good sense. Trying to do my sadhana, but I wasn't really present. As I was, you know, with my mantra, but I wasn't really there. And suddenly there was this great shout in my meditation saying, "Wake up!" You know, and I was, "Oh!" You know. So the bodhisattva, the Buddha's love that wakes people from their sleep. So again, in the Sangha, the love we generate for one another, yes, matures and cherishes, but it shouldn't be cozy and sleepy, where everything is sort of safe. The love we generate for another will need to be bracing sometimes and challenging and stimulating and waking us up. And we've heard quite a bit about Vimalakirti, the way Vimalakirti does that. In fact, the great love of a bodhisattva removes the root delusion, the delusion that prevents the attainment of Buddhahood, the belief, the deep conviction that there is a real self and real others. That's the basic ignorance. I'm here, you're there. We're completely sort of separated out. And because I believe that, I try to grasp hold of those of you who I like, and I push away those of you who I don't like. I have craving and aversion coming out of that ignorance. Sometimes, of course, you'll change paces. One minute you'll be doing things that I like, so I'll want to draw you to me, and one day you'll be doing things I don't like, so I'll be pushing you away. But it's all coming from the root delusion. But metta bhavana, maitri bhavana, loving kindness, begins to dissolve away all that. It begins to dissolve that separation. It's why metta bhavana is such a powerful spiritual practice. It's an insight practice. It's a wisdom practice, metta bhavana, because it's dissolving the root delusion. You know, in that fourth stage, with that enemy, there you are. You're right up against the root delusion of self and other. Fantastic. You're facing it, honestly. No pretense. No, empty Buddhist words. There you are. Self and other. And you're dissolving that self and other. Metta dissolves the separation between ourselves and all others. I say all not just our favourite others, because you can feel, well, I'm not separated from my girlfriend. But it's all others, not just the people you like. And this is, of course, what happens in the Sangha. We dissolve distinctions in the Sangha. You know, it's an amazing thing about the Sangha. You know, you actually start loving people who you thought you could never actually love. So Vimalakirti says that the Bodhisattva generates the love that is non-dual, because it's not involved with the internal or the external. It's a love that has dissolved that distinction between in here and out there. And this, of course, means that the Bodhisattva's love is completely natural, completely spontaneous, in the sense, you know, there's no self-consciousness about the love. He doesn't regard the love as something he owns. It's not a possession. It's not in here. It's not out there. Bodhisattvas never think of how much they love others, of how much they do for others, of how many classes they take or support, how many talks they give, how many retreats they do, of how much they help others in the hurly-burly of life, of how much they give to their family, give to the people in their workplace, how much they do for charitable work. There's none of that. There's none of that self-consciousness. Their love is unself-conscious and completely free-flowing. They don't even regard it as their love. Our teacher Sangharakshita has said on more than one occasion that the goal of metta bhavana is to experience a sort of free-floating loving kindness. It's not yours, it's not others. All those distinctions are transcended. So there's no tension, no ego tension in a bodhisattva. So in Buddhist texts, the bodhisattva is depicted as doing so many things for others. But for him, this great work, as it's called, of ripening living beings, is play. It's lila, or sport, lalita. It's fun, it's a laugh. Deeply serious, deeply meaningful, but play, sport, spontaneous. So the great love isn't onerous or heavy, but light and enjoyable. And we need to kind of get that into our practice. You know, we've got to have that perspective on ourselves. Sometimes we can be so sort of heavy about our spiritual life, you know. Kind of lighten up, you know, and, you know, don't make it to such a kind of ego trip. Indian Tantric Buddhism describes this state as sahaja, which has a number of meanings, but the best meaning is spontaneous, natural. It's the natural state of two in one. The natural state of emptiness and love, emptiness and bliss. I say natural, but please don't misunderstand. To become sahaja, to enjoy sahaja, you have to work, you have to practice very, very hard. The bodhisattva naturally, spontaneously works to bring all beings to the highest happiness, the highest bliss. He wants to bring them all to the deepest satisfaction and ease. But it's all fun. And this is the last thing that Vimalakirti says regarding the great love. He says, the bodhisattva generates the great love, which is happiness, because he introduces all beings to the happiness of a Buddha. So we need something of that in the Sangha as well. We're not going to get very far in our spiritual life if we're all uptight and neurotic and touchy about what we do. We need to lighten up. So let's work, let's open up to that free-flowing, natural, great love, and let's have fun practicing the Dharma and bringing the Dharma to all beings. And it really is magical, this great love. In fact, metta is magical. Metta bhavana is magical. In the end, it's impossible really to describe and evoke this great loving kindness. We have to live it, we have to be it, we have to be in it. Above all, we have to express it in deeds. And we'll be living a real Buddhist life then, and we'll be, if we're practicing together, we'll have a real Sangha, and we really will be building the Buddha land if we're developing this great love. We'll be creating an environment in which people can ripen and mature and develop towards Buddhahood. So just a moment ago, I mentioned the tantric notion of sahaja. And sahaja is sometimes seen as the constant companion of the tantric bodhisattva. Padmasambhava's staff there, which he holds, is actually the state of sahaja. And it's embodied in a feminine form. There's one of the great tantric masters named Shabra speaks of his wife, or she says, describes herself as his natural wife, and her name is Sahaja Sundari, which means lady naturally beautiful, or the beauty of naturalness. And this Sahaja Sundari is not external to the bodhisattva. It's not his sort of pseudo-spiritual girlfriend. It's an image of his natural abiding in emptiness and loving kindness, his natural abiding in and with the great love. And it's interesting this, because after the teaching on the great love, and after a very perfection of wisdom dialogue between Manjushri and Vimalakirti, which ends up talking about what is the root of baselessness, suddenly there appears out of nowhere a goddess, a Devi, who lived in Vimalakirti's house. She was so astonished by the dialogue going on between Vimalakirti and Manjushri, the dialogue of great love, about the great love, the dialogue that leads to what is the root of baselessness. She was so astonished. The text says she was well pleased, delighted and transported. She was so pleased that she assumed a gross material form and scattered everybody present with beautiful heavenly flowers. It's an absolutely wonderful moment in the sutra when this happened. I mean, years ago when I was doing a retreat on this, we were doing readings from the sutra and doing groups and meditations on the sutra. And I remember when the goddess turns up, it's an absolutely wonderful moment. You've had all this dialogue, and then it says, a goddess appears. The goddess has no name. She's just the goddess, the Devi. In the text, there's no description of her. We don't know whether the form she takes is golden or green or blue or white. She's just the Devi. And she sort of creates a space, in a way, for our spiritual imagination to fill. You know, what does she look like to you, this Devi, when she appears in the sutra? Whatever, she is beautiful, mysterious, strange, and the flowers she's strewn stick to the poor Shravakas and Shariputra. They can't get these flowers off, whereas they just slide off the bodhisattvas. And she speaks words of deep wisdom in response to Shariputra's questioning. She even magically transforms Shariputra into herself, into her feminine form, and herself into Shariputra, and then does all that. She's a shapeshifter, a magician herself. And she also speaks, she evokes the great wonders of Vimalakirti's house. It's an extraordinary place, this house. Among them, she says, well, as soon as you enter this house, all klesha, all defilements vanish. And in this house, the Dharma is always resounding. And it seemed to me when I was studying the Vimalakirti Nidesha on that retreat that the anonymous Devi, the goddess appearing at that moment, embodies the great love of the Bodhisattva. The love that pours forth from the realization of emptiness. The great love that delights in the Dharma, that delights in the ripening of living beings. The great love which is extraordinarily beautiful. It's not just wise, it's not just loving, but it's extraordinarily beautiful. It's very interesting, in the early traditions of Buddhism, the Buddha teaching of the Pali Canon, the Buddha himself says that metta, which is the Pali form of Maitri, metta leads to a formless liberation, an arupa vimoksha called the beautiful. And when you really dwell in metta, you are liberated into a state of great beauty. And this great love transforms. It undoes all of our limiting concepts and hindrances. And it's a love that will disturb us because it will challenge our deep-seated views of ourselves. Vimalakirti says of the goddess at the very end of the chapter, through the strength of her bodhisattva vows, she goes wherever she wishes to bring about the ripening, the maturing, the developing of all beings. And this is where all our Buddhist practice should lead us. This should be our aim. We practice, we realise the great love to bring about the ripening, the maturing, the development of all beings, so that they all may enjoy the great happiness, the great bliss of Buddhahood.